88.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. The word fascism gets tossed around a lot these days, but what does that word even mean? And what does it mean to call, for instance, the Trump regime fascist as opposed to or in addition to authoritarian or autocratic? And what about terms like ecofascism or petrofascism? So last fall, I interviewed University of Oregon professor Sarah Wald, and we touched on the term ecofascism. That sent me down a little bit of a rabbit hole on that term and the dangerous myths that many environmentalists may be unwittingly buying into. Sarah was kind enough to connect me with the Anti-Creep Climate Initiative, a collective working to expose ecofascism ideas and myths that permeate our culture and media. And maybe this sounds like an esoteric subject, but I think it has real-world importance. Because our beliefs and actions are often shaped by stories and myths and narratives that are so subconsciously ingrained in us, they become like the air we breathe. So to talk about all of this, my two guests today are two of the co-founders of the Anti-Creep Initiative, co-presidents of the Association for the Study of Literature and Environment, and professors at the University of Connecticut, April Anson and Alex Minrisky. I won't lie to you, dear listeners. These two very smart people went a little over my head at times, but I learned a lot from this conversation. As always, we went a little long, so for our radio listeners, you can hear the full interview by searching for Coast Range Radio on any podcast app. Send me an electronic mail sometime and let me know what you think of the show. My email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. April Anson, Alex Minrisky, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation today. Ever since I spoke with Sarah Wald a few months ago, I've had you all on my radar and yeah, super excited to talk today. So let's set a little foundation here for folks that maybe didn't listen to that conversation with Sarah or just as a refresher. What is fascism and what is ecofascism? So really easy questions to start off with.
I'm very happy to take that question. One of the biggest things that's concerned me in my work over the past few years is kind of something that actually I think has been talked about a lot is the utility of the term fascism. Why use it? It can seem really kind of maybe watered down, especially if in moments of high political tension, everyone's sort of just pointing fingers and yelling that the other people are fascists. Mm-hmm. Defining that word has been really important to me, especially if I want to study something like ecofascism, I better have a solid idea of what fascism is first. So when I think about fascism, I'm thinking about, okay, well, why is that word useful? Why not a word like authoritarian, right? Let alone a word like conservative or liberal or socialist or anarchist, any kind of like political designation. Why fascist? What is it that makes it distinct and special and a useful word? So it's really just describing, you know, populist ultranationalism. Obviously, when we think of fascism, we think of like this really strong fixation on this idea of nationhood and nationality, really essentialist definitions of those things, who belongs and who doesn't, often based on arbitrarily defined characteristics. And of course, kind of the accompanying military and paramilitary violence and repression of not just folks abroad, but, you know, a given nation or other communities' own citizenry and membership. One thing, though, that I think often really gets left out of these definitions, though, and this is, I think, really the really most important component of fascism that distinguishes it from other things, is the fact that historically it appealed to folks left, right, and center, like kind of all over the political spectrum. And it was really the popularity, the grassroots popularity. There wasn't a top-down imposition of authoritarian power. People loved it. People were into it, right? It appealed to a lot of people across the political spectrum. And a big reason that happened is due to kind of another feature of fascism that distinguishes it from other kind of political isms, right? Liberalism, conservatism, socialism, anarchism, all of these diverse kind of political sectors have like a body of work. They have a theory. They have an intellectual tradition. They have like a literature. You know, they have, you know, you can look at thinkers. You can look at John Locke for liberalism. You can look at a variety of folks for conservatism and so on and so forth. Fascism as a tradition does not have that. Another scholar, George Moss, described it as a scavenger. It was really, really kind of rooted in longstanding nonpartisan cultural narratives in a way that these other political philosophies were not, right? These other political philosophies are put out there as like a, we should be striving toward this. We're going to take this program and we're going to kind of apply it. Fascism was very organic. It was working with like deep-seated, several hundred year old stories that, you know, in the case of Germany, for instance, the German people, left, right, and center, were really kind of bound up in, right? You know, like in the US, it would be like things bound up in a mythology of the American West, for example, right? You know, the heroic individual, like these storytelling elements that are really deep rooted in a society. So fascism succeeded to the extent that it did in the early 20th century because it was really rooted in common storytelling patterns and not a political theory. And it appealed to people across the board. And those storytelling patterns were sort of remixed in new ways by people in power to make violence against certain populations seem attractive and necessary. So this kind of everyday storytelling is really central to fascism. So when we talk about eco-fascism, we're talking about something really similar, right? You know, there's this kind of perceived period of decline and, you know, a set of individuals has a really canny facility with deep-seated cultural storytelling patterns, remixes them in a way that kind of scapegoats others. And I guess one other thing I would add about fascism definition is can really only happen in the modern world, right? In a post-industrial world. You know, fascism happens when social inequality reaches a sort of tipping point. And rather than kind of address the root causes of that social inequality, namely like extreme rapid wealth accumulation, it sort of papers over those causes and redirects blame toward a scapegoat, right? Everyone feels like society is in decline. They feel that way because of this rapid expansion of wealth inequality. And then some canny people remix, you know, social storytelling elements to redirect blame to some kind of scapegoat. That's how it worked in the early 20th century. One could argue that fascist movements in the years since have worked in very, very similar ways with varying degrees of success. If we're talking about eco-fascism, we're talking about a similar kind of dynamic, except maybe we're not talking about perceived decline of a nation. If we were talking about perceived decline of a bioregion or the planet as a whole.
In actually a zine you all put out recently, you went through some of the big eco-fascist myths and helping to set the scene and again, ground us a little bit. I wonder if you could just really briefly preview a few of those and then we can kind of dig back in a little bit. But at on a surface level, some of these things that like you all were saying to a lot of us are just the air we breathe and don't really think deeply about.
So I think since you also, what's come up a little bit is kind of like the storytelling. I think maybe the best two of those myths, if we just want to focus on a few of them, the best two of those myths to maybe talk about, because April also already brought up the COVID-19 pandemic, and I know she can talk a lot about this. I think maybe two of the most illustrative myths from that list are, one, humans are naturally tragically selfish, and two, humans are a virus. They kind of go hand in hand. And who among us hasn't seen some rhetoric out there somewhere where it's kind of like humans are a plague on the earth, we're destroying the planet, you know, which goes hand in hand with this idea that humans are naturally tragically selfish, right? That humans will always inevitably destroy their resources, right? And that's an old idea, probably most popularized in the 20th century by Garrett Hardin in his famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, essay, The Tragedy of the Commons.
I was just talking with somebody in my last interview about that. So, all right, two Garrett Hardin references in 1 week.
Yeah. And you know, I'll just really kind of quickly sum up the Hardin thing and then pass it over to April, who can maybe talk more about the like humans are a virus part. But Hardin's whole thing was, you know, the reason the commons and like shared management of resources is a bad idea for Hardin is because humans will always act selfishly and kind of deplete them. And Hardin's kind of like, you know, solution to this was privatization. And a few things to say about that, though, right, are, you know, it's really important to think historically about that claim as well as, you know, as well as just purely numerically or mathematically, not numerically, mathematically, right? I mean, to think historically, first of all, right, the relationship between the commons and privatization is a very, you know, historically specific one, right? You know, the commons did not, you know, just implode. You know, we have countless examples of peoples the world over at different periods in human history, you know, kind of continuously across human history. There have been people who have successfully for long, long periods of time, successfully managed resources, kept societies afloat and healthy, and also, you know, safeguarded, you know, environment and non-human others. Countless examples of that. Where the commons starts to collapse, in fact, is with this sort of history of colonialism and settler colonialism, you know, really just a few hundred years ago, let's say 500 to 700 years ago, a classic kind of starting place in many studies, although it is by no means the starting place, is with England's occupation of Ireland. You know, Ireland had kind of worked, you know, successfully with a commons-based social organization for quite a long time. England wanted those resources. It came, it privatized, did the same thing all over again in the contemporary United States, right? What is today the United States? Or the Americas writ large, right? Variety of European powers. And that's a really, really poor, impoverished, really quick summary. But then also the mathematical thing, right? You know, like, just kind of like, you know, Hardin's arguments really start to break down when you actually pay a lot of attention to them. Thomas Malthus's arguments on which Hardin based his work start to break down. The economist Elinor Ostrom won a Nobel Prize for kind of really disproving this. The problem with, like the relationship between population and resources is not a numbers problem necessarily. It really depends on conditions, but it's often a distribution problem. Most often, 99% of the time, a distribution problem. You know, like a very small number of people kind of hoard these resources, and that ends up being what causes some kind of like collapse or disruption to an environmental and economic and social system. I'll just kind of end the spiel about Hardin by also pointing to the brilliant scholar Rob Nixon, right, who has argued really persuasively that one of the reasons Hardin became so popular, and so many people who don't even study the things Hardin was studying know about the Tragedy of the Commons, is because, how does he put it? Nixon says he created a tag team between generic and genetic forces. Mm-hmm. He used this kind of like, not quite, but almost apocalyptic storytelling, you know, template. And he paired it with kind of repeated assertions about like humans being genetically predisposed to selfishness. And the combination of these things work really well when it comes to pathos, right? And it really resonated with society, especially in moments of like social and environmental crisis or unrest. Right? But the more important thing really is that humans are a plague thing, right? So I'll hand it over to April to talk more about that, right?
Well, I think just to maybe transition or link what you were just talking about, the humans are a virus fiction was something that just reached me at a very intimate level at the beginning of COVID, where many, many people in my personal spaces were sharing memes of like the clear canals, right? Which is, you know, yes, we love to see it. We love to see it. But then using that as evidence that, you know, of a kind of inevitable doom is just so, so, counterfactual. It is so counterfactual to the whole of human history.
Right. Yeah. 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 Historical.
ahistorical. It obviously ignores the research. It has that kind of self-fulfilling structure. And we really see that self-fulfilling structure in, and forgive, we can you can edit out this pivot if you want, but like in contemporary mass murderers' manifestos. So thinking particularly about the El Paso mass murderer, who was citing and loosely plagiarizing the Christchurch mass murder earlier in 2021. Both of those mass murders. 2019. Whoa. Oh, the years happen. Their 2019 manifest or texts rather were then like really, really plagiarized by the 2023 Buffalo shooter. In Buffalo, New York. And so we can see how the like this template that Garrett Hardin is modeling for us of self-fulfilling fictions just get picked up and reinforced. And in that way, do I think kind of form an intellectual tradition in a way that scholars of fascism, I think, are correct to see the scavenger. I do think eco-fascist ideas have a bit more of a through line. Mm-hmm. A little more tensile strength or something. Yeah.
Talk about how we as activists need to be addressing some of these tropes and myths in our own circles.
Yeah, I guess I want to say maybe something I should have mentioned earlier. So I was born and raised on Kalapuya Ilihi, which is currently called Eugene, Oregon, and really grew up just steeped in, environmental activists. Not like sub, you know, I don't want to claim more like street cred than is due. My family was hippies and mill workers that weren't particularly activist oriented, but the rhetoric from Earth First and the tree sits and spikes and the spotted owl debate, that was all part of how I understood my environmentalist concerns growing up. And so The claims like humans are a virus and especially population control appeals were part of my common sense growing up. Like there was, I should have no more than two children, replacement levels, et cetera. and I think it's because of that and Alex and I have kind of similar but divergent experiences of growing up in these, like, you know, maybe more working class white cultures that made these appeals and it felt like it did feel like an environmental ethic for me and a viable one. And it wasn't until, you know, really early grad school that I started just realizing like none of these things are viable. And how is this just repeated over and over and over again?
I wanted to ask a couple questions that prepping for this discussion brought up for me. Something I have been really fascinated with is the debate in the environmental and climate, I would say, justice communities around like growth versus degrowth as a way out or through the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like the degrowth movement plays into some of these eco-fascist mm-hmm. tropes. I'm sure that some people would very strongly disagree with that statement. I'm wondering what mm-hmm. you all think about if and how that some of these tropes play into these so-called degrowth arguments and if that can end up being counterproductive to mitigating climate change in an ecologically and socially just way. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you totally disagree and take the other tact, and I'd love to hear either way.
Yeah, I wonder if I'm curious to hear Alex's answer to this because I have a kind of back history with it a little bit. So when I was in grad school, I got very involved in the tiny house movement, and I built a tiny house and lived in it for grad school. And the experience in that was so different than the rhetoric about tiny houses that really drew me in, kind of the kind of the degrowth, I think, ethics of tiny houses. And so I wrote a bit about it and was writing a chapter for inclusion in a volume on degrowth. And the reader reports that I got back were very hostile to the fact that I pointed out that the degrowth movement was inspired by the Club of Rome document, which is just full of population, appeals to population control and misunderstandings. And I think it really comes down to this misunderstanding of the very real limits of the planet that we are on, confusing that with the structures of global capitalism, and not getting toothy in the critique demanded by what a degrowth ethic, I think, promises, which is can be really radical, right? I guess that's the personal experience with that. But I do agree with you, Michael.
The way I would answer it, it's going to be really similar to something I said earlier, right? It's about the simplistic versus nuanced, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that like any movement or any rhetoric, any discourse, right? You know, there are variations depending on who is doing the talking and where at any given time, right? I mean, I think it can trend toward those kind of, like Club of Rome, like a population kind of conversations again. But by the same token, it can also trend toward, I've seen it trend more toward asking those questions about rates of production and consumption, not just rates, but the type and sort, right? You know, like we're humans, we're going to build things. That's what we do, you know, and that at least I'm going to say something controversial and say that that's an inevitability. We are going to build tools and we're going to use those tools, right? But what this, I think that April used the word radical, right? What makes it radical is it offers this opportunity. I mean, the opportunities are everywhere, but the occasions very rarely happen, you know, like this moment that very rarely happens in contemporary US culture to kind of take a moment and ask, well, what kind of like building, what kind of, what does growth mean? Right? What does it look like? What does degrowth mean? What does it look like? Right? And this is what I mean by the more nuanced, right? Can we take a moment to just say that definitions of production, consumption, population, growth, and degrowth, those are not settled things. You cannot take those for granted. Take a moment and think about, okay, we need to produce and we need to consume. Right? We have to, right? And when we use those words as shorthand, we normally mean them in the negative sense as tied to profit seeking, wealth hoarding, like turbocharged capitalism, right? They don't need to mean those things, right? And at certain times in history, they haven't meant those things, right? So when, like I mentioned earlier, right? Like we have tools that are very useful. They've increased human well-being, right? And I think about, I don't remember where I read it, but somebody kind of said, I think it was in a book by Adam Briggle, who's an environmental studies professor, I want to say somewhere in Texas. I feel bad for not remembering, but his name is Adam Briggle. He said in a book that he wrote for students, it was a student-facing text, something like, the challenge that we have in front of us is to try our best to maintain 21st century standards of well-being, different than a standard of living, right? You know, while returning maybe to something like an early 19th century kind of pattern of you know, resource usage or that part's up for debate. But the idea of being like, how do we maintain human health and well-being that we've gotten used to, which is a very positive thing, while returning to other modes or other sorts of production and consumption, right? And I think that's the real question. That's a more interesting question than just kind of taking these words and their definitions as givens, like, but thinking instead about, okay, like I said earlier, like, how do we build things that don't break? How do we get away from a planned obsolescence mindset, right? You know, even that would make a huge difference in the way we produce and consume and in our relationship with the planet, right? And that's just one small, tiny tip of the iceberg thing, right? But I think that those are the more positive and interesting and radical for me potentials of the idea of degrowth is this opportunity in this occasion, in this moment for like kind of actually sitting down and asking about, not like rejecting the ideas of production and consumption, but thinking about them as human qualities and thinking about them in normative terms. What sort, like these questions are asked all the time in kind of environmental studies, like what sort of world do we want to live in? Well, what sort of production is good for human well-being? What sort of production is good for creativity and leisure and also survival? You know, like what sort of production and consumption do the most good for us, our bodies, our communities, our more than human communities?
The reason I wanted to bring this up and mention the myths and tropes of the degrowth movement is in circles that I run in, this idea of degrowth as like the way out of the climate crisis and out of capitalism are so pervasive. And I don't disagree with a lot of the ethos of it, mm-hmm. and the directionality of it. I disagree with the timeline. And I also think how we would get there in a very short timeline, I think plays right into that eco-fascism lens, because we're not going to democratically get the United States to radically scale back on our per capita consumption, especially not of the 1%. So what is that going to look like? A takeover and forcibly pushing people backwards in that sense? So I really appreciate you all engaging with that, because I, like you said, Alex, it requires a lot of nuance in the thinking about it.
The question, as you asked it, Michael, reminded me of the critic and professor Sarah Jaquette Ray has this story about how she travels around giving lectures on climate anxiety and like race. And on more than one occasion, she's heard from student listeners that they'd be willing to embrace a green dictator if it meant solving the climate crisis. So to your question about like the time scale, right? You know, and like she hears that sort of thing often. And she's not the only faculty member who thinker who talks about these things on a circuit who's heard that sort of thing. I guess a key word in this conversation has been inevitability, right? And it's like, even if we are thinking about like time scale and like the short time scale that appears necessary to work on, right? That route is itself not an inevitability. And I think a really weird counterintuitive place to look for that is actually the far right itself, right? You know, you mentioned your listeners are mostly, you know, pretty left. Like there are plenty of challenges involved when it comes to the contemporary far right, plenty of other prejudices that I'm not even like touching at the moment, right? And plenty of things to like kind of worry about. But there is a weird kind of counterintuitive hope in this kind of like, you know, fascist resurgence at this moment. And it is the fact that a lot of people on the far right are reacting to the things people on the left are reacting to.
Yeah.
They share a distrust in wealth inequality and the concentration of power in the hands of a few. The left and the right are really on the same page about a lot of things. They're on the same page in many cases when it comes to their critique of capitalism. There is a lot of shared economic and class-based critique on both of these sides, and that has produced already, especially in the past like year and a month, some interesting, weird, unexpected partnerships in certain parts of the country, often very locally based, right? But there is a shared critique when it comes to these questions in more places than people realize, when it comes to, you know, the economics of class, when it comes to environment. People on the far left and the far right are actually have a lot more in common, it seems. In fact, when it comes to thinking about really like solutions, I would honestly say probably the biggest stumbling block, again, if we're really just narrowing in on these things, the biggest stumbling block is the center. If we're talking about convincing people that they should give up or alter their rates of consumption or their sort of consumption, it's people in the center. Those are the people who are standing in the way of that. Those are the people who are the hardest to convince. But the kind of hopeful part is that, again, despite all the other challenges, when it comes to these questions of extraction, consumption, production, wealth, and relationships to land, there is, I think, a lot more fertile earth in that kind of like circling that political spectrum from left to right than I think most people realize. And I think there are opportunities there, despite those other
That's all we have time for today on Coast Range Radio. Like I said at the top of the show, there was a lot that I couldn't fit into this radio version of the interview. You can listen to the full conversation and all of our episodes free and ad-free on any podcast app. Coast Range Radio is an independent, volunteer-run show. Follow us on Instagram if you feel so moved. The show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Would love it if you'd say hi sometime. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
Tommy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back end of year campaign. With your support, we exceeded our $75,000 goal. Now,